and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the 5 million internal emails from the private intelligence firm Stratfor that was hacked into by Anonymous, who passed them on to WikiLeaks, who released them today along with a press conference in London featuring the Yes Men, who were the target of an investigation by Stratfor on behalf of their client Dow Chemical. Mark Perry, an intelligence and foreign affairs analyst, joins us to discuss the quality of this data dump. Then we'll look into the Obama administration's proposed overhaul of corporate taxation and how much of corporate America's record profits are being hidden abroad in tax shelters. Scott Klinger, the tax policy director of Business for Shared Prosperity, joins us to discuss why corporations are sitting on piles of cash as their political hirelings beat the drum for more corporate tax cuts, while the economy remains stalled because of the lack of demand by consumers who don't have purchasing power because they are being downsized. Then finally, we will discuss the Republican primary campaign in Michigan, where Mitt Romney is making appeals to restore the endangered middle class while bashing unions. Al Benchich, former president of UAW Local 909, who retired from GM after 36 years, joins us to discuss how the denigration of unions has accompanied the downsizing of the middle class and how the concessions the UAW made in the so-called government bailout have helped revive General Motors at the expense of providing new workers with a living wage. Joining us now is Mark Perry, a military intelligence and foreign affairs analyst and writer. His articles have appeared in Foreign Policy, The Washington Post, and The Los Angeles Times, among other publications. He is the author of 7 books, including Eclipse, The Last Days of the CIA, and his latest, Talking to Terrorists. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Perry.
Good to be here.
And as far as I can tell, Mark, the real scandal about Stratfor here, that there was a press conference today in London at the Frontline Club by WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, and WikiLeaks expressing outrage at the contents of this 5 million worth of emails from Stratfor. It seems to me, given that Stratfor has clients like Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, Raytheon, and government agencies, including the U.S. Department of Homeland Security and the United States Marine Corps and the U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency, I would argue, surely, that the real scandal is that Stratfor's so-called intelligence is pretty worthless.
I think if you made that argument, you'd be absolutely right. I woke up this morning and heard about this leak and went online to check out these documents, and I was sorely disappointed. This is, in my opinion, this WikiLeaks so-called dump is overhyped, very exaggerated. I didn't find anything new in here. There's a lot of emails between Stratfor employees speculating on intelligence and speculating on what might be true and what might not be true. But there's very little usable stuff. I think the Frontline Club press conference today showed that this stuff was really overhyped. It's almost as if WikiLeaks now, having given us what they can, are really reaching for something more, and they just don't have it.
So this is the sort of a version then of the blind leading the blind, where you have Stratfor hyping their usefulness and their access to intelligence. Then you have Anonymous thinking they're actually hacking into something that's really some deep, dark government secret. And then they pass them on to WikiLeaks, who then releases them as though these were nefarious activities of something that actually mattered.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And what I was really hoping here was that Anonymous would hack into these emails, that WikiLeaks would release them as a means of showing us just how transparent, superficial the intelligence matters that Stratfor purports to report, just how superficial all of that is. Listen, I've watched Stratfor for many years now and been given a number of their reports, and in my area of expertise in the Middle East and terrorism, they never struck me as quite right. There was always something a little off about them. And I was always asked to subscribe and to comment, and I never really felt the compulsion to do so because none of the hardcore material that they report is really that hardcore. You can make phone calls and get better material than this. I've been consistently disappointed in the Stratford products, and I've never understood, frankly, why corporations and people like the DIA and the U.S. Marine Corps would even subscribe. It seems to me to be a waste of time.
And Henry Kissinger, I mean, it's hard to know, actually, whether some of the big names that they that were leaked by Anonymous, along with their credit card information, I might add, were complimentary members or whether they'd actually paid. One of the complimentary members, by the way, Mark Perry, is the controversial Pakistani General Hamid Gul, the former head of Pakistan's ISI, who for all intents and purposes is working overtly with the Taliban.
Well, yeah, I met, what's very interesting about what you just said is that I first met George Friedman, the head of Stratfor in Doha several years ago at the same conference where Hamid Gul was in attendance and was able to sit down with General Gul and have a cup of coffee, and you can ask him things in the open. He'll admit them. It's no great intelligence to go and talk to Hamid Gul. But what struck me about the head of Stratfor, who gave a talk to a group of Middle East journalists, was just really how, you know, haughty, frankly. I mean, he could be the nicest man in the world for all I know, but during this particular conference, he was the ugly American, lecturing Arabs on how they could do better and how America is the has the greatest values and is leading the way in the world. And it really came off, you know, as kind of a planned arrogance almost. Very, very disappointing. And I thought, you know, for those of us who report on the Middle East, we take a certain humility and a certain modesty in what we know and what we don't know, but not the head of Stratfor. And that's how the reports have come off, too.
Again, I'm speaking with Mark Perry, a military intelligence and foreign affairs analyst and writer. He's the author of seven books, including Eclipse, The Last Days of the CIA, and his latest, Talking to Terrorists. Some of the stuff that's come out, that at least we've seen, I've been trying to get hold of the list of the journalists that they that Stratfor claims to have had on the payroll, as you know, to use the old KGB adage of useful idiots that do their bidding. Some of them apparently paid up to $1,200 a month. The list that I was able to get offline was almost entirely foreign journalists. I haven't seen the American list. Have you seen the American list?
I haven't seen the American list, and I would bet that if we see it, if there are any really high-profile names, they'll be embarrassed. And it's telling, but it's also telling that Stratfor would pay journalists for information. Isn't that what Stratfor is supposed to be doing, aren't they?
Right. It's supposed to be the other way around.
Yeah, isn't it supposed to be the other way around? I mean, you know, if you look at, there are a number of corporations like Stratfor who are very good, actually. One or two are quite good, but they're very quiet, and they don't advertise their product. You find out about them. And they work very hard to put together summaries, and they don't put them out until they've really got something hard. Stratfor comes out all the time with what they say is intelligence, and actually it's speculation. It's what they've heard. Well, you know, the job of a journalist is not to just write down what he hears, but to write down what he hears and then go find out if it's true. And Stratfor doesn't seem to have that kind of method of operation.
Well, it seems, though, Mark Perry, that this whole Stratfor operation is a kind of wannabe operation. Some of the stuff that WikiLeaks came out with today indicates, you know, the internal gossip at Stratfor about their CIA cronies and buddies and all that stuff. Most of the stuff that I've read looks like it comes from low-level military intelligence people, and then some of the stuff there, memos from Friedman to a Stratfor analyst on the 6th of December 2011, a relatively recent one, on how to exploit an Israeli intelligence informant providing information on the medical condition of the president of Venezuela, Hugo Chavez, saying here, you have to take control of him. Control means financial, sexual, or psychological control. We're talking about the so-called control of the Israeli intelligence informant. I mean, that's like a poor man's version of one of those cheap intelligence books. You know, what's the guy? What's the series that they do now, based on the Ludlum novels?
Yeah, exactly. Well, you're exactly right.
Yeah, Jason Bourne. That's right. Yeah, like a fantasy discount Jason Bourne.
Well, in reading some of these, I agree precisely what you said. Reading some of these internal memos, it sounds like people have been reading too many, you know, grade B novels, spy novels. You know, listen, I have CIA cronies and people from the agency who are now retired. I talk to them regularly, and one of the things I find out when I talk to them regularly is that they're out of the loop. As soon as you leave the agency, you're out of the loop. It's not like dealing in drugs that you can never get out of it, or being part of the mafia that you can't ever leave it. It's when you leave the CIA, you leave the CIA. And when you're sitting down with a man who's been a 30-year CIA veteran and he retired 5 years ago, he's absolutely out of the loop. They're not, you know, they can speculate, they can tell you about history, but they can't really tell you about what's going on right now. And that's the hardest thing to crack, is to get somebody at the very senior levels of the intelligence services to sit and talk with you, because the punishment for sitting and talking with you is you lose your job, you lose your pension, you lose your security clearance, you lose everything. So it's very unusual to get that. And I scanned the Stratford documents, or the WikiLeaks documents on Stratford today, with an eye towards what level of sourcing did they have. And I came to the conclusion that you did, that this was probably low-level military intelligence at best. And perhaps, you know, some people who've been retired from the agency who are speculating on things. But other than that, I didn't find anything that really curled my hair here or made me say, ooh, that's really interesting. It's just not there.
So, again, I think, Mark Perry, the real scandal is the fact that the U.S. taxpayer is being fleeced here by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, the U.S. Marine Corps. Apparently, Stratfor prepared a study for the commandant of the Marine Corps, to our tax dollars at work, and the U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency.
Here we are running a huge deficit, and we're spending money on subscriptions to have people tell us what is manifestly not true or speculation. You're absolutely right. That is a scandal.
So, what do you make then, Mark Perry, of this effort on the part of Stratfor to make a deal with Goldman Sachs? Apparently, they made a deal with Managing Director Shay Morantz. And this was a deal that Stratfor CEO George Friedman hatched to utilize the intelligence and to combine that with a strategic investment fund, what they called StratCap. And apparently, this looks like a bit of a scam to me, but somehow or other, Friedman managed to get this Goldman Sachs guy, Morantz, to invest more than $4 million as the price for joining Stratfor's board of directors.
Well, when you that was the most interesting part, I think, of the revelations, is that the mask here kind of dropped on what Stratfor really is and has been, which is a money making operation, which is just fine. Nobody's against a company making a profit, but when you make a profit on information that is suspect or speculation, and you hype it, and there's a lot of hype in Stratfor, you know, and there are. I've been in conversations with, corporate officials who just really get thrilled by this insider. Here's a person with insider knowledge, and it's going to cost me a lot of money, but I can really get some good insider knowledge, and it is. It struck me in this WikiLeaks documents as this was a scam. Maybe there is a legitimate business opportunity here for Goldman Sachs, but I really, in reading this material at least, I doubt it.
And a lot of it's to the Stratfor Vice President for Intelligence, a guy called Fred Burton, who's formerly a special agent with the U.S. Department's State Department's Diplomatic Security Service. I mean, that's, you know, I talked to former people from the Bureau of Intelligence and Research, the INR, which is
INR, yeah.
Who are the real guys. But yeah. I never thought that the Diplomatic Security Service was anything more than, you know, bodyguards.
Diplomatic Security Service is not an intelligence unit. They might be given actionable intelligence in providing security, but they are not intelligence collectors. They don't run officers to collect. To get intelligence, they don't have access to the highest level cable traffic. They don't understand sources and methods and aren't trained in sources and methods. This is a security guy. There isn't anybody there from the group you mentioned, INR. Doesn't seem to be in any of these documents anyone from the CIA with high level intelligence or DIA, certainly not from the NSA. So, you know, where is the expertise here? Where is the credibility and the legitimacy of the people who are running the operation? And when you read these WikiLeaks leaks, you are left wondering that.
Well, you're sort of left wondering about not just the gullibility of the U.S. Agencies like Homeland Security, the Marines, and the DIA that bought this stuff from Stratfor, but the gullibility of corporate America. I mean, not just the defense contractors like Lockheed Martin and Northrop Grumman and Raytheon, but, you know, one of the more interesting things that came out today was the Yes Men were at the press conference in at the Frontline Club in London, and apparently Dow Chemical hired Stratfor to look into what the Yes Men might be up to on the anniversary of Bhopal, which was the hideous incident that took place where hundreds of people were poisoned. And I believe Dow Chemical assumed it, did they not, from the original owners?
Yes, that's right. That's right.
Union Carbide, I think, had it before.
Union Carbide. I mean, I have only an arm's length relationship with that story, so I'm not an expert on it. But I key off of your statement about gullibility of corporate heads. They're not the only ones. We all sat here not too long ago in the United States while members of the press and terrorism experts told us that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. And a lot of people bought it, and very high-level American officials bought it, and very high-level American officials were involved in, I believe, faking that intelligence.
You mean the smoking gum as a mushroom cloud?
Yes, the smoking gum, the mushroom cloud. And so, you know, while I looked at these documents today and I shook my head about the gullibility of people who would buy into this, I also remember that it wasn't too long ago that tens of millions of Americans bought the same stuff. And we look at television every night, and there are experts on the Middle East and experts on terrorism who have never been there. And that just happens to be a fact. We have to be very careful and very skeptical of operations like Stratfor. I'm sure that their customers must have been very satisfied with their product, or they wouldn't have bought it. But I, at least, am very skeptical about it.
Well, just in closing, Mark Perry, we talked about how leaks of the names of all the journalists from this thing they call, I can't actually say on the air what they referred to their Confederation group as, the Confederation Partners, they call it something. That will get sued by the FCC for mentioning. I looked through the list as far as I could see, journalists from all around the world, with code names, some of them like Geronimo. But one of them that came up is that what Stratfor referred to as an information mule with the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, the defense correspondent Yossi Melman, who supposedly conspired with the Guardian journalist David Lee to in violation of the Guardian's contract with WikiLeaks to move the WikiLeaks U.S. diplomatic cables to Israel. But what is interesting about it is the Stratfor saw the whole WikiLeaks thing as a possible gravy train that they could then sell to corporate security, saying, you know, we'll be the guys to plug future leaks to prevent your own employees from stealing your sensitive information.
Yeah, I noticed that, and I thought, you know, when I am asked on those rare occasions when I'm asked to talk to journalism classes, I tell them the same thing. You don't need to buy information, and you don't, you know, you. There's nothing secret about getting it. The hardest thing for a young journalist to do is the hardest thing for a young intelligence officer to do, and that's to pick up the phone and talk to people who know. If you dial the right number in the right order, you can talk to anyone in the world, and it's amazing how many people will tell you what you need to know, and you've got to dig. Don't allow other people to do the digging for you. You can do it on your own. And that was always my not just Stratfor, but other information agencies too. If you can find out for yourself, it's always better. And of course, the cardinal principle is just because somebody tells you something doesn't mean you should put it on a piece of paper and put it out in a report. You have to check and see whether it's good information. And from what I see today on this document dump, my feelings about Stratfor have been confirmed. It's just not that professional an intelligence gathering organization.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Mark Perry.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Mark Perry, who's a military intelligence and foreign affairs analyst and writer. His articles have appeared in Foreign Policy, The Washington Post, and The Los Angeles Times, among other publications. He's the author of 7 books, including Eclipse, The Last Days of the CIA, and his latest, Talking to Terrorists. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back speaking with Scott Klinger. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Scott Klinger, who is the Tax Policy Director for Business for Shared Prosperity. He's a chartered financial analyst and previously worked as a security analyst and portfolio manager for Walden Asset Management. He's one of the authors of a recent report, Executive Excess 2011, The Massive CEO Rewards for Tax Dodging. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Klinger.
Thank you, Ian.
And the president recently came out with a plan to revamp taxes, particularly corporate taxes. I noticed that Mitt Romney is on the campaign trail making an argument that the reason that there's so much corporate money offshore is because they don't pay taxes, but they pay taxes on onshore money. And he's saying it's a disincentive if you pay taxes in the United States and you don't pay them abroad. So what's he saying there?
Well, U.S. companies do pay taxes on your U.S. profits, and they've become very skillful at disguising their U.S. profits as if they were earned overseas, particularly in tax haven countries, which are about 50 countries around the world, sometimes little island nations that offer very low or even no tax rate, no tax on corporate income.
So how would you then repatriate this capital?
So companies, as long as they earn money overseas, or if they transfer their U.S. profits overseas, they don't pay U.S. tax on it until they bring the money back, which is what you just referred to as repatriation. When they do, they pay the regular U.S. tax on it.
which is what Romney's arguing is a disincentive. If you get punished for bringing money back to the United States, that was his argument. And I guess, frankly, doesn't that resonate with the average voter?
Well, I think it probably does, but that there's a lot of misinformation in it. First of all, we have a tax system, corporate tax system, that's badly broken, and corporations in general pay nothing like the 35% corporate rate that we often hear about. In fact, the Congressional Budget Office did a study a couple weeks ago and found last year corporations paid just 12% of their income in taxes, the lowest tax rate in 40 years in this country, and much lower than companies in Europe or Asia generally pay.
So one of the arguments that I heard that attended the president's announcement of reforming corporate taxes was essentially that why give another tax break? I mean, that seems to be the essential problem here, isn't it? That we have a kind of economic illiteracy in the country where a lot of people think that the deficits are terrible things and we have to cut the debt, yet the evidence of austerity in Europe indicates the opposite. And the other canard seems to be the idea that if you relieve the wealthy and the corporations of their tax burden, that creates jobs, that they're the job creators. So can you tell me, Scott, why it is that these canards aren't effectively challenged and persist?
Well, I think that, unfortunately, we've become very susceptible to soundbite politics and these easy phrases like job creators. The reality is that U.S. corporations have never been better than they are right now. They're reporting record earnings. They're sitting on more than $2 trillion, with a T, in cash, and they could create hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of jobs tomorrow if they wanted to. They have that much money in the bank. The problem isn't that their taxes are too high. The problem is that they don't have any consumer demand to justify those investments. And it's a chicken and egg problem. When companies start to hire and create jobs, then consumers will feel more confident and begin to purchase things again. So, we really don't see any connection between this argument that corporations are making, that their competitive advantage is affected by U.S. taxes. Warren Buffett was recently in the news in the last day or two talking about the fact that the U.S. Corporate profits as a share of our total economy are the highest they've been in 50 years. And at the same time, corporate tax contributions, corporate taxes as a percent of the economy are the lowest they've been in 50 years. So we have this widespread, and that is going into CEOs' pockets and into shareholders' dividends and capital gains.
Well, I understand that this huge surplus of corporate profits that you mentioned, the trillions, are in fact being used to buy back stock, which then raises the price of the stock and makes the CEO look good, and therefore he can claim more money. Isn't that what's going on?
That's right. That's certainly one big piece of the way the money is being used.
So let me try and understand then why corporate America is sitting on all this money. They have record profits, a record low taxes, and yet they're talking about being too heavily taxed. And you're saying that nothing's going to improve until there's some demand. It's not that they are getting taxed too much. It's that the people out there don't have any spare change to buy their products. You would think that corporate America would be concerned enough to want to do something about it. But what are they doing? Are they sort of holding back, sitting on their coffers in order for Romney to get elected? What's their strategy here? What explains the fact that they don't have some kind of patriotic impulse to want to improve the American economy so that the average American has some purchasing power to buy their products?
Well, I would respectfully disagree with the notion of a patriotic impulse. Corporations are not people, contrary to what Mr. Romney said, and I don't believe they have impulses. Most of these companies are global businesses. They don't think of their allegiances to any particular place or community, and that's different from what it once was, a few decades ago. When I was a kid, companies saw themselves as rooted in a particular place, and they took care of those places. That is much less the case today. They're very much concerned about profits. So one answer is to help them, is to force them to pay the taxes that they're supposed to pay. And there's a couple of bills in Congress. One that our small business owner members support is the Cut Loopholes Act that was recently introduced by Senator Carl Levin and Senator Kent Conrad from North Dakota. And that would close some of these offshore tax haven loopholes. It would eliminate other loopholes that corporations get, such as when they pay their executives in stock options, they get to deduct huge amounts, hundreds of millions, billions of dollars off of their tax bill for those stock options that overcompensate CEOs. There's 42 corporate loopholes that passed that expired at the end of the last Congress in what's called the Corporate Extenders Act. And Congress right now is considering extending all of those 42 loopholes. Some of them are decent. Some of them are good economic policy. Many of them are not. And these are things we don't read about in our papers and don't, you know, as you said, don't have the knowledge we need to be good, active citizens.
Again, I'm speaking with Scott Klinger, who is the Tax Policy Director for Business for Shared Prosperity. He's a chartered financial analyst and previously worked as a security analyst and portfolio manager for Walden Asset Management. And he's one of the authors of a recent report, Executive Excess 2011, The Massive CEO Rewards for Tax Dodging. So what then is the president just sort of playing politics here with his proposal? On the one hand, he is trying to neutralize the constant Republican canard of big government spending by suggesting that there ought to be tax cuts, but at the same time closing loopholes. It's pretty much the same argument he's had with tax policy in general. What's your sense of why he sort of wants it both ways?
Well, I think there are some fairly good things in the president's principles that he outlined. I wouldn't say he's yet put forth a proposal, because it's very much lacking in any details that can be evaluated. But some of his principles are that companies should pay taxes on their foreign earnings. They shouldn't be able to house hundreds of billions of dollars in tax havens, countries around the world. They should pay some global minimum tax. The problem is he hasn't specified what rate that is. And if that rate is too low, then that becomes a permanent tax holiday, tax cut for corporations, and we'll see even more money shift to those countries. If it's a very high rate, then that could actually end up closing some of those tax havens and making corporations pay the taxes that they're intended to pay. Europe, by the way, has these sorts of laws. The UK, France, Germany all have laws that require companies to pay some minimum level of tax on their foreign income. It's usually pegged as a percentage of their national tax, and that would work in this country. But the president has not yet put forth a number on that. So those kinds of things are good. The biggest problem we have with his tax plan is he is wanting it to be what he says is revenue neutral, in which any additional taxes that are raised would be put into new tax cuts and tax incentives for corporations. This country and this country's businesses need more investment. We need investment in basic research. We need desperately need investment in infrastructure, in job creation. And we're not going to get there if corporations are paying no more than the historically low level in taxes that they're paying today.
So do you think American corporations are not interested in the 99%? In other words, arguably we have become a kind of oligarchy now, ruled by corporate plutonomy and oligarchy. Arguably, our democracy itself is up for question. And we talked earlier about, when I use the word patriotic, you pointed out this absurdity of that notion, or the naivety of that notion, that because corporations are global, it sort of takes you back to Adam Smith's notion that capital transcends sovereignty. Is there any corporate responsibility out there in terms of responding to the 99% versus the 1%? I mean, I would think that a plutonomy or an oligarchy is unsustainable in the long run because the rich, even though they've got so much money, aren't sufficient to create to sustain an economy that's, I think, 70% dependent upon on consumer spending. Don't you have to trickle down a little bit to the average people so that they can buy your products? I'm going back to that.
Well, I think that's absolutely right, Ian, and I think that's the tension and the problem is between short-term thinking, how are we going to get our profits for next quarter, and long-term thinking about what is this country going to look like when people are up to their eyeballs in debt and don't have adequate jobs, and the jobs they do have are paying less than they used to. Those are not conditions that are healthy for an economy, as you said, that's based on consumer spending. And it's not just this country that corporations need to worry. That story is playing out in many, if not most, countries around the world. So I think corporations are being very short-sighted when they're not creating the resources for government to invest in in good education, in good infrastructure. These are the things that make economies competitive. These are the things that we're losing to places like Korea and China, where they're investing massively in educating their citizens and building great transportation networks and great infrastructure to help their businesses succeed.
But do you think that there's the fact that a presidential candidate in Rick Santorum can make a statement that the president is a snob because he wants American kids to go to college, and that Santorum thinks that going to college is a bad idea? He also thinks that homeschooling is a good idea, and that public education, I think by extension, you assume he doesn't think much of public education or the need for it. Is there a constituency in this country, in the business world, that would reflect Santorum's thinking? In other words, we don't need a skilled, educated workforce because of the globalized economy. We've already stripped our manufacturing base. We basically just want low-wage workers who are passive and will accept whatever we decide to pay them.
Well, I think the evidence is that not what I think or what you think, but that other countries of the world definitely think that education is the way to advance their businesses and their economies. We see all around the world countries investing far more and significant resources in preparing their young for careers, whether that's through college or through good trade schools or whatever the education is. But education is certainly key. And, I think the United States has lost that, has stepped away from it. And one of the things you mentioned, low wages, there was a new report that just came out that looked at the percentage of low-wage jobs in countries. And the United States, among industrialized countries, has the second highest share of low-wage jobs in its economy, and the only country that's worse is Korea, South Korea. And one of the things that has just been happening, I don't know if your listeners are aware, but Caterpillar has just gone through a nasty strike in Canada and is closing down a plant and moving it back to, I believe, Indiana, because it's now a low-wage, non-union state, and they can save money. So the U.S. is gaining some jobs back because we've become the low-wage place to do business. And we know from the auto factories that we're celebrating are coming back that the new workers being hired there are making half of what folks were making a few years ago when the factories were all closing.
Actually, less than half, $14 an hour is the entry.
Compared to 35 or 40, right?
Yeah. So so Mitch Daniels, the governor of Indiana, who just signed the right to work law, he's already getting results.
Right, because the U.S. is now the low-wage place to do business. And that's not good for business, though, either, because those workers will be living paycheck to paycheck instead of having some disposable income that they can spend on things that corporations might have to sell.
I'm mystified as to why anybody would consider this social engineering beneficial. What's the thinking here? Is it just greed that the CEOs want to take all the money and they just don't want to share it? Or is this some new, as I was suggesting earlier, some idea that in order to be competitive in the globalized economy, we got to turn our American workers into Bangladeshis and Sri Lankans?
Well, I think that a big piece of the problem is that many of us have given up our sense of our own story and where it is we fit in this grand economy. And too many people have embraced the notion that their well-being is based on the well-being of corporations. So when we hear things like taxing corporations is going to create jobs or high taxes on corporations make them uncompetitive, we become fearful instead of examining what's really going on. And let's look around and see, who's doing really well in this economy. I mean, it's not my neighbors. It's not most people that live here in Baltimore. It's the biggest businesses, the most powerful businesses. It's not the small community restaurant or community dry cleaner. They're struggling. But there's a lot, huge amounts of wealth that's being created and redistributed upward in the society. And that's something I think we all need to come to grips with.
But given the power of corporations and now because of the Supreme Court Citizens United decision, their ability to buy our politics has even greater potential than they had before. And we're starting to see in this election cycle how a handful of billionaires are essentially through super PACs are choosing our political leaders, at least if we're to be have a Republican president in the next 4 years. So just in closing, I'm trying to get a sense of how these candidates like Santorum and Romney talk about reviving the middle class. At the same time, the policies and the practices of the corporations, who, after all, are the real influence in our politics and particularly in the Republican Party. This is not the old American dream anymore, is it? We're talking about essentially making the people like Romney, who are practitioners of extracting wealth from companies and concentrating wealth amongst the elite and then stripping companies of workers. And then this right to work stuff that's just happened in Indiana, and with the UAW deal with General Motors and Chrysler lowering their wages, that seems to be the way we're heading, right? We're heading into a future that doesn't include the middle class.
That's absolutely right. Unless we do something pretty quick, we're heading for a permanent aristocracy. Both Santorum and Romney's tax plans and economic plans would massively shift wealth to those at the top, the biggest corporations and the wealthiest families. In fact, they'd be their tax plans would be the Bush tax cuts on steroids. They'd generate even more savings and wealth for those at the very top of the economic ladder.
Well, Scott Klinger, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Scott Klinger, who is the Tax Policy Director for Business for Shared Prosperity. He's a chartered financial analyst and previously worked as a security analyst and portfolio manager at Walden Asset Management. He's one of the authors of a recent report, Executive Excess 2011, The Massive CEO Rewards for Tax Dodging. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with a retired president of UAW local in Michigan about the race there and what really happened with the so-called bailouts. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Al Benchich, who is the retired president of UAW Local 909. Al retired after working for General Motors in Michigan for 36 years. Welcome to Background Briefing, Al Benchich.
Good to be here, Ian.
And Al, obviously you're being bombarded by super PAC money that's dominating the airwaves in the state of Michigan one day ahead of the what's a very important primary, a Republican primary vote, with Romney's fate pretty much on the line. At least that's what the pundits tell us. What's your sense of how this election's going to go?
From my point of view, none of the Republicans have a economic platform that would help the people here in Michigan. And so regardless of how it goes, whether it's Santorum or whether it's Romney, their economic platforms don't address the issues that face the people in Michigan.
Well, Santorum, of course, has been focusing on social issues. But hasn't Romney tried to point that out?
Well, but his comments around what's important here in Michigan, at least, in regards to the auto industry, in regards to unions, points to in a direction that he wants to free up corporations from give them free rein. And that's at the detriment to working people.
So I understand there are some robocalls coming in pretending to be Democrats, but it's from Santorum's campaign. Have you come across that?
No, I haven't.
I see. Well, let's talk about, since you're retired president of UAW Local 909 and you retired from General Motors after working for them for 36 years in Michigan. A while back, Mitt Romney wrote an op-ed in the local paper there in Detroit, basically criticizing President Obama's auto bailout. First of all, I think you're arguing with the term itself that it wasn't a bailout to General Motors and to Chrysler. It was a loan in both cases is being paid back.
Yes, it is. It was a loan as opposed to the bailout the banks received with no strings attached. The loan that the auto industry received had very stringent strings that included the renegotiating of contracts that basically reduced wages in half and reduced other benefits.
So that doesn't sound like it was a win for the union members.
Well, that's what Romney's trying to picture it as to people, is that somehow this was Obama's a gift to the auto workers union and to the union bosses, as he calls them. And somehow reducing wages by half was a gift.
So you're one of those union bosses, and doesn't sound like you doesn't sound like you agree with it.
You know, the thing I'd like your listeners to remember is that, you know, my grandfather worked in mines in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and most of the people who are in their 40s or 60s, their parents were the first people of a really middle class, or maybe even their grandparents. Before that, you had, in this country, the rich and the poor, or working class people. You know, people were farmers or craftspeople. The only middle class were maybe merchants, doctors, engineers, and the like. What created the middle class was the Industrial Revolution with the advent of unions fighting for our fair share, you know, the working people's fair share of the pie. That's what really created the middle class. And, you know, Romney and the rest say they want to, you know, fight for the middle class. Well, that was the people who benefited from the Industrial Revolution. And as we've seen in the last 20 years with the decline of unions, so has the middle class declined. And, you know, they're wanting to have right to work. You know, look at the important things they're pushing. Right to work. Let's get rid of unions. Let's get rid of birth control. Let's, you know, those aren't the issues affecting most people in their day-to-day lives. What's affecting them is access to jobs, access to health care, and those are the things that we need to be talking about.
So, but what how do you react, for example, to when Romney, I mean, aside from talking about how the trees are the right height in Michigan, that's pretty hard to decipher what actually meant there. But he also said that, pointing out that he had a pickup truck and a Mustang, both made in Detroit, and his wife had a couple of Cadillacs, just sort of off the top, gratuitously, indicating a kind of cavalier, wealthy kind of attitude. But then he was down at a NASCAR event, and he told the Associated Press that he really doesn't identify with the NASCAR fan so much, but he does have some friends who own NASCAR teams.
Yeah, his identification is with the uber rich, obviously. I can tell you from a personal experience. I lived for 10 years in the neighborhood, one of the nicest neighborhoods in Detroit called Palmer Woods. Four houses down from where I lived was Romney's childhood home, a very nice, I guess you might say, mansion. It was a small mansion here in Detroit. Unfortunately, it was uninhabited and falling, you know, it had become decrepit. It was like a blight in the neighborhood. And the neighborhood organization, knowing this had been the house that Romney lived in and grew up in, wrote to Romney on any number of occasions asking if he could help in the restoration of the home. You know, they weren't asking him to do everything. They were hoping that they would have some sentimental value. Family, you know, his family lived there. He grew up there. And never once got a response from him. So those kinds of things don't matter to a Mitt Romney.
So what happened to the house?
It was demolished. It was torn down.
And yet Romney's running on his Michigan roots, isn't he? And in this
case, yeah. His house is no longer in Michigan.
But
I doubt if he has a house in Michigan. His father was here when he was head of American Motors. His father was governor of the state. But he's way to the right of even his father.
Well, is it true, though, that his father was quite held in esteem and was in even affection?
I think during that period, I was fairly young during that time, but it seems to me that he was well-regarded by people in Michigan.
So, again, I'm speaking with Al Benchich, who is the retired president of UAW Local 909. He retired after working for General Motors in Michigan for 36 years. How do you feel, then, about where GM is today? You mentioned how that contrary to what Romney is campaigning on, that somehow President Obama was helping out his friends in the UAW, and you point out that hardly the case, given the lower wage tier that the new entry workers have, what's $14 an hour, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And
that's not much better than what you could hire somebody on a street corner here in Los Angeles.
You know what? The other thing he's saying is that the loan also gave the UAW a lion's share of ownership of GM, which is not true. What it did do was there's what we call a VEBA. It's what now pays for retiree health care for retired GM, Ford, and Chrysler workers. And there are several hundred thousand retired people who count on the VEBA for their medical care. And that was supposed to be funded by money from Ford, Chrysler, and GM. And because of the bankruptcy, they owed money to the VEBA. And so GM stock went to fund the VEBA instead of them giving the cash, which underfunded the VEBA, which means that the VEBA does not have the amount of money in it that it was supposed to have to fund retiree health care. But that's what it didn't go to the UAW, and the VEBA is trying to sell the stock as soon as it gets up to an amount that'll, you know, properly fund the VEBA. They're not trying to be owners of General Motors. But that's the way Romney is. It's a totally false picture he's trying to paint in his campaign.
Well, but you're in Michigan, and he's trying to obviously appeal to Michigan voters, albeit Republican voters. But surely Republican voters in Michigan know all this stuff, don't they? They know what happened. They know what the deal was. They know that it wasn't a bailout, that GM is being paid is paying back the government loan. They also know that GM's doing very well, don't they? I mean, how can you make an argument that this was a terrible thing that Obama did?
I don't know how you make that argument. I mean, I do know that shortly after I retired, which was just before I retired in June of the year, GM and Chrysler declared bankruptcy. If someone would have told me that by December that GM would be bankrupt, I would have thought they were nuts. But here it was 6 months after I retired, they were going to go to Washington. So I became part of a group of auto workers, active and retired auto workers, called Auto Workers Caravan. We went to D.C. that December prior to the passage of the loan to lobby for taking the money and investing it in the closed plants to retool the plants, to reopen them, to make wind turbines, solar panels, high-speed rail, the things we need for the future of this country. And that we, you know, many of the windmills we buy are from overseas.
from China
being
in particular.
Erected here. Yeah. And why can't we be using our factories? We've got skilled labor. We've got the factories. We've got the equipment to do this. Why can't we be doing that here in this country? And, you know, that's helping our environment and helping create jobs. And that's what we argued, that the bailout, not the bailout, but the loan would be used to create jobs that way, because no jobs were really created with the loan. It protected the jobs that were there. Fortunately, since they're doing so well, they're able to hire more people now, which is obviously a good thing. But we thought it would have been much better spent reopening closed plants, retooling them, and creating the products for the future for a green create a green industry in this country.
But that sounds suspiciously like big government, doesn't it? I'm being sarcastic, but did anybody in Washington listen to you?
Well, we spoke to several senators. We were, what's his name, the senator from Alabama that was totally against, spoke to his staff.
Shelby, and, right.
Pardon?
Shelby?
Shelby, yes. Yeah. Thank you. Right. We spoke to Senator Shelby's staff and didn't get anywhere, but we let them know what we thought.
Well, I thank you for joining us here, Al Mencich. You know, we just wanted to get a feeling for what's happening in your state on the eve of this important primary vote tomorrow, and it seems that GM and Chrysler have become a big factor in this race, and it's just mystifying to me why Romney would take this approach, because it doesn't make a lot of sense.
It mystifies me because, you know, not only would it be over 100,000 GM workers and an additional 40-some thousand Chrysler workers that would have been directly affected if both corporations would have went belly up, there's an additional almost 1 million jobs that are directly tied to the Chrysler and GM, you know, suppliers, the stores around the plants, and everything that's connected to the auto industry. And it would not only have been devastating for Detroit and Michigan, it would, you know, in the midst of this economic turmoil we're in now, that would have been probably, you know, the final nail in the coffin. We would have had a full-fledged depression, in my mind.
Well, Al Mencich, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Al Mencich, who is a retired president of UAW Local 909. Al retired after working for General Motors in Michigan for 36 years. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.